On the Book Show with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Well, here we are toward the end of 2020, a year that started out with such great promise, pretty relative expectation of normalcy, and ended up so very, very different. To talk to us with a basically day-by-day breakdown in the first half of the year of what happened in the time of pandemic is John Sternfeld, who is the compiler and editor of Unprepared, America in the Time of Coronavirus. It's from Bloomsbury Books. John is a former editor and co-author of Crisis Point with Senator Tom Daschle and Senator Trent Lott, A Stone of Hope with Jim St. Germain, and A Forever Family with Rob Scheer, among other nonfiction books. So when you first started compiling all this data that you include in your book, where did you go to establish a baseline? Where did you start? Where and what kind of people did you start investigating?
Well, it's funny. You know, we started originally with the president, word, and a few governors that had been appearing on TV every day, Governor Newsom in California, Governor Cuomo in New York. And pretty early, my editor and I realized that, well, if this book is just a collection of politicians' words, there's going to be too many lies in it. That sort of came up like day three, I want to say. So we immediately realized that we needed both a regular COVID-19 death count, which we got from Johns Hopkins University, and The Atlantic also had something called the COVID Tracking Project. And then we started looking at straight-up statistics, right? So cases per day, deaths per week, where it was spiking, and then we started to fill it in with politicians, union leaders, journalists, anybody that had a platform and what they said that day. So the book operates almost like a diary, where you begin on December 31st with a doctor in China who was the first to spot it, and you go all the way to June when it had spread both medically, but we also had, you know, a racial crisis in this country. We had social issues. So it's sort of, the book mimics the spreading of the virus.
Now, you tell the story in five phases: the arrival, when we first find out about things, the emergency, the lockdown, the opening, then the reckoning. At what point did you decide, okay, this is going to be phase one? Or was it pretty easy once things started really getting more complicated in a hurry?
Well, it's funny, you know, that actually came in hindsight, because if you remember, you know, it was March and we'd heard about this virus, and then all of a sudden the kids were home for like a long weekend, and then they were home for a week, and then 2 weeks, and then all of a sudden we looked up and we were no longer on hiatus, but we were like transforming as a society. So the lockdown didn't really feel like a lockdown when it first happened. It felt like this little brief vacation.
Right.
It was not until late April, when people started opening again, that we're like, oh my God, we were, as a society, locked down for 8 weeks. So really, it was at the end of compiling the book where we had this sort of massive information in quotes, where, you know, the decision was made, okay, we're telling a story, let's follow the virus's arrival, its reaction in our society, you know, the entire lockdown of the country, the premature reopening. And then the last section of the book is called The Reckoning, because I was finishing up the book during Memorial Day weekend, which was when George Floyd was killed.
Right.
And immediately the protests that sprang out of that, it occurred to me that this was not a separate story. This was sort of a culmination of a lot of the issues that had come up during COVID-19 pandemic. Communities of color being neglected, people feeling like their government was apathetic about them. Everything came to a head with those protests. So the book actually ends on June 5th at the end of the second week of the protest.
Now, I've also heard it said that one of the things, and I kind of felt like this without diminishing any of the tragedies that brought about the massive demonstrations, I also thought, you know, we've been all had our lives kind of shut down and locked in for months, and people can only sit around their house so long before they just say, I got to get out and I got to do something. And when you're sitting there watching television day after day and you're hearing more and more reports about things that are upsetting you, at some point you're going to say, I've had it with sitting in here. I'm going to get out and I'm going to say something or be somewhere where I can make my voice be heard. And I don't think that was the only thing that was going on there, but I do think it was a contributor to the way it all kind of broke out almost simultaneously.
Yeah, I agree. You know, there was the literal people wanted to get out of the house, but there was also this sort of, you know, we lived for a few months in a very top-down society, right? Like our governors and mayors were on TV, and there was like these testing centers, and nobody was in control, right? The average citizen could wear a mask and protect their family, but you're right, there was no collective action, right? Or at least our leaders were not giving us an opportunity for it. So with the Black Lives Matter protest, what you saw was a community of people who recognized that this incident in Minneapolis was not an isolated incident. It was something much larger that spoke to the same problems, right? The people that had to go to work, right? There were people in our society in March and April that were risking their lives to drive a bus or to work in an emergency room.
Right.
So I think a lot of those frustrations came to a head, and you're right, people wanted to speak out. Now, there was definitely footage of people protesting who were not being responsible, but overall, at least from what I saw and I studied for this book, the protests over George Floyd's death were mostly organized. The people were wearing masks. They went out of their way to keep it within the standards, to keep it as safe as possible. I did notice in the news, it became sort of a political cudgel to say, oh, you say what we have to stay home, but now you guys are allowed to protest. Well, there is a difference between going to a bar because you feel like it and marching with a mask on. You know, those are two totally different things.
And I can add two things to that. This is a small town, but we had protests here too, but everybody was very orderly. There were never counter-protests. Everybody was doing the social distancing and masks and everything. It was very orderly and very stately, you know, a respectful kind of, this is why we're upset. And my oldest son, who's in the movie business, went out to Oregon about that same time, and he said, when I got back, people asked me about, wasn't it dangerous about the riots and everything? And he said, I was all over the city, and I knew there was something going on, but there was never this massive thing that was endangering the lives of thousands of people or something the way it was reported on television. And I said, with all due respect, I said, you're a journalism major. You remember what this means. When you have video, that's what you lead with. And
exactly. And
you either use the video to make everything look like it's an apocalypse, or you use the video to say nothing happened. Seldom does it seem like vivid pictures are used in a responsible way. It mostly just seems like they're used in a way to hype up a viewership of a particular television.
Absolutely. And those images were recycled. And it was useful from a political standpoint. There was a large portion of state governors who wanted there to be no lockdown, right? So whether it was they were coming out against masks or they were opening too early, it was useful to demonize the Black Lives Matter protests, right?
Right,
it was both racially motivated, but also economically motivated.
And politically on both sides of it, too, because there were people who said, hey, this is my chance to say I don't like Trump, and other people were saying, hey, this is my chance to show I support Trump. So it was kind of, again, going back to everybody's tired of sitting around, everybody wants to do something.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the toughest things about all of this year has been some of the phrases that we've been forced to learn, and to me the worst of them is non-essential jobs.
Right.
That's easy to say if you've got a ton of money in the bank, or if you have a job like, congressional aide, which means you never have to worry about not having a job. But if you're a guy that works for a living, or a gal who works for a living, and you pay your bills because they kind of expect the bills to be paid, that's not non-essential. That's essential to that family to stay at the level of comfort that they have.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it represents the soullessness of, you know, bureaucratic terms, right? So, you know, I'd said this many times over the spring, but nobody is a non-essential worker to themselves,
right?
So, like, this idea that we could separate society and people who need to work and don't need to work. And I guess that was one of the many things people were boiling in anger about, was this idea that you're treating me like I'm not essential, but to my kid who needs to eat, I'm very essential.
Exactly.
And there was a lack of sympathy and there was a lack of action, even though there was some early congressional action. Overall, what you saw was every man for himself, every state for himself.
Yeah.
And a lot of it began when the president was able to benefit by taking responsibility off himself to put testing on the governors. That really started this cycle of politicization. You know, if you look at early March, the politics was pretty minimal.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, it became beneficial to certain people in power, especially our president, to create an ally and an enemy. That is how he operates, and that's how he operated here. But when you have 50 different states, you cannot have them bidding against each other for PPE. You cannot have them setting up testing centers. You know, we needed a national plan from the beginning. And the problem was that the president felt that a national plan would have landed on his doorstep.
Well,
but I think that it comes back to that original choice.
Yeah, and I think, too, you've got 50 governors who all want someday to be president or something. You
mm-hmm.
know, nobody wants to just have their career end up being governor. And
right. Nobody wanders into the governor's mansion.
Right.
That's right.
Right. And so here's a chance for all 50 of them to go, hey, I'm important. You know, I'm in Delaware or Vermont. I'm just as important as Texas and California because I get to decide if people wear masks or not, or if they can go to church or if they can go to a bar or a restaurant or something. And I think there's plenty of blame to spread all around because everybody, it seemed, in any position of power has kind of abused it over the last, 7 months or so.
Yeah, there was a lot of signaling going on, too. You know, there were some governors that were signaling, like, I'm going to let churches stay open no matter what, right? Like, even when the recommendations were to close churches, right? Or,
right.
I believe in freedom, so there's no mask mandates anywhere. There was a lot of, like, ideological baggage going in with each governor's order, whereas
mm-hmm.
if there was just a national plan, we would have gotten rid of a lot of that. But I agree that the governors were motivated by their own ambitions or their own voters or whether or not they were up for election. And people's health was, you know, on the table.
Yeah.
You know, it's so horrible to say, but they gambled away with people's health. And it's still happening.
I've read a couple of other books, of course, over this period that talked about the technical stuff, the scientific stuff, the immune system and so forth, coronaviruses, et cetera, et cetera. So I know a lot more about that stuff, and hopefully my listeners do, than we did a year ago. But I think one of the things that struck me through all of this is that there are still far too many people who are not really willing to trust scientists
mm-hmm.
And researchers when they say things like this could be a terrible pandemic. Because in the past, we've gotten warned about, this is going to be bad, and then it turns out to be not so bad. And everybody, it becomes the cry wolf syndrome. And now it's impossible for us to actually say, well, at first they said 2 million people were going to die. We only had 200,000 people die. So they must have been wrong.
The president is arguing that. Yeah, he is arguing that, but it is absurd on his face.
Yeah, because there's no way to prove it or disprove it, you know? Because what are you going to do, have a test state? Where everybody says, okay, we're not going to wear masks and we're not going to do this or that, so let's just see how many of us drop dead.
Right, and the 2 million number came from if nobody did anything. Right?
Yeah.
So it's like not a single American wore a mask or stayed home from school or anything, 2 million people could die. But giving credit to the government for saving, you know, 1.8 million is just sort of nonsensical.
And I know another thing that gets said a lot is, especially in the early days of this, people were very quick to compare it to the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic. And
mm.
and there are some, there were at least originally, some comparisons that were valid. They masked in those days, and they didn't really know why, because they didn't really understand what was going on. Whereas we have the benefit of more modern medicine that was able pretty much early on to say, okay, this is why we've had this thing, and this is why it's going to be dangerous for us. They didn't have that a century ago, and we didn't have global travel like we do have now 100 years ago either. I mean, we barely had airplanes, and now we've got them zooming all over the world.
Which makes the state-by-state policy even more ridiculous, like you're saying. Like, the idea that most people stay in their town or state, like America, is completely interconnected as an idea,
right?
So even if philosophically you think you care about states' rights, it would not make any sense for there to be 50 individual testing plans. And it's completely frustrating. And also with the Spanish flu, it went away and then it came back in the fall. You know, we have that lesson for us.
Right.
But we have not garnered it. And it's funny that you say they do less, but they also, you know, it was almost like the faucet is bigger now, so we got more information.
Right.
And we also got a lot more nonsense, too, to sift through. And the country, I think, is in trouble because too large a percentage is anti-science. I mean, I think that's just a fact.
Yeah.
That there's a lack of trust for the research process, for bureaucratic scientists or government scientists. And even though they were right, they are still treated as suspects.
Yeah.
And I think until the country as a whole gets its media system and its scientific authority, until those things are fixed, we are going to experience this over and over again in various ways. It might be a cyber attack next time, who knows? But if people don't trust experts and people don't trust the news they read, we're nowhere. You know, we're absolutely endangered of going through this all again.
To me also, it reminds us that we as the news media have a responsibility to not just jump into stuff halfway, that we need to be informed before we try to inform other people, that we don't need to be so eager to be the first people with the story as we are the people with the story that has all the facts. And we can't wait 5 months for it, but we could certainly wait until we have a chance to talk to somebody who knows something. Even on a local level, we have a university here. Well, there are a lot of very smart people at that university who teach here. We have a school of nursing here. We have a lot of medical experts. And talking to those people might take a little time, and it might make people have to listen a little more intently and longer because you can't explain it in 30 seconds. But I think it's worth the effort rather than just jumping on and going after one exciting story after another to build. I fault the news media, as a member of the media myself, I fault us for not in the past being a little more careful about what we put out there so that people could trust what we had to say. I think that's part of the issue, too, that they don't trust the government, and they don't necessarily trust the people that are telling them stuff.
Absolutely. You know, we also have a larger percentage of the news media now are, you know, opinion personalities than they used to be.
Right.
Right. So journalists used to mean something, and now it sort of doesn't mean the same thing. And, you know, the intro to the book, I go out of my way. You know, I'm not a journalist. I go out of my way to thank journalists and to give them credit and to talk about the fact that without them out there every day tracking what is going on with this virus, we would not know what to think. And the fact that this administration has demonized the media in a very dangerous way makes it even harder for us to clear through what's real, what's not real.
Right.
But it's a serious problem. When the pandemic goes away, you know, I feel like we need to have a reckoning with the media in this country, because the size of these conglomerates, they are so powerful, right, that they can overrule, you know, what the president's, you know, scientific advisor could say.
Yeah.
And those kind of things are dangerous.
It kind of reminds me, okay, this is a strange analogy, but as you were talking, it made me think of this, that at one point, Babe Ruth, the iconic baseball player, was asked about his salary, and he made more, and the reporters, it has said, said, that's more money than the president makes, and he said, I had a better year than the president. And I feel like that's the way it is, really, with news networks on radio, for example. I know more about that than I do about TV. Almost every single news network, no matter what side of the political aisle it's kind of teetering on, they all belong to Westwood One.
Mm-hmm.
All of them. ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, CNN, all of those belong to Westwood One. Now, do I think that they all have their own separate news stations and they all have their own separate staffs and everything like that? I think probably not, because if you buy up a bunch of things and you consolidate them, what are you going to do? You're going to cut out the superfluity, and that means you're not going to have as many reporters, editors, and other people in positions of authority who can say, I don't like the way that our rival is doing this. Let's find a different, better way to cover this story. Because if they're all working for basically in the same building, is that going to happen?
Yeah, there's the reason why, you know, the death of local media, which I know people like don't want to hear about it, but it's really sort of like a civic duty for there to be like a local newspaper and a local person you could trust. Because what happens with these economies of scale is if you can buy up, you know, 35 of the top 50 markets, and if you have somebody on top who has a political agenda, that's it. You know, mm-hmm. game over. There's no way to inform the public in a way that I think, you know, when we first started dealing out radio airwaves, what the idea was.
Yeah.
And I think the reason the book was necessary is that the noise from the opinions and from the blogs and from Twitter was so loud each day that sitting down at the end of the day and say, okay, who said what, when, you know, and were they right? That's basically what the book is. It's right. Like, let's turn down the fire hose to a level that we can manage it, because at some point we're going to get overloaded. And we got overloaded pretty fast with false information or disinformation. But it was the journalists that kept it steady. And I think of the book in the tradition of, you know, historical records, where it was like, while it was going on, everything was flying at us fast, but then somebody sat down and put this together. So.
I think it was a gargantuan task for you to put this book together. And I think it absolutely makes for fascinating reading. Was there anything in here, lining these things up on days and so forth, was there anything that really surprised you a lot?
Well, it was difficult, but I think, you know, in order to make a book like this readable, there had to be repeated characters, right? So besides the president and the governor of my state, I tried to single out, you know, heroic people who were doing their best, or, you know, error-filled people who were causing more damage. And I think it was pretty easy to find across the political spectrum heroic people. So if your listeners open the book, they will find there's no political affiliation in the book. So every
right.
governor, senator, congressman, they are not identified as Democrat and Republican.
Right.
And I did that for a reason, because this pandemic seemed to be, you know, beyond politics. And there were certainly Republican governors, and I think of Mike DeWine in Ohio and Governor Hogan in Maryland, who, when you read their words, you could not tell what political party they were in. And I feel like that was the kind of heroism we needed. But then you had other people, like, you know, Senator Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, who was intentionally labeling the blue states as having high death counts, or calling it a blue state bailout. So there were those who were looking to transcend politics, who I think of as heroic, and those who dragged it down, who I think of as, you know, responsible for a lot of the misinformation.
I would say that there are some lessons learned through all of this, too. For example, one thing that we learned is that nations are going to watch out for themselves first. As much as we'd like to think all the nations of the world would be honest with each other about absolutely everything, that is ridiculous and completely naive to think that.
Mm-hmm.
And second of all, I'm thinking that decentralizing manufacture of essential things like medical supplies and things like that is a really good idea. And we, you know, Walmart might have gotten Band-Aids cheaper because they're making them somewhere in China, but shouldn't everybody make their own Band-Aids, and shouldn't everybody make their own ventilators and things like this? Even little countries, shouldn't it be a smart thing for them to say, you know, it wouldn't be so bad if we had a Band-Aid company around here somewhere.
Right.
Just in case.
Yeah, there had been people warning about that, you know, over the past 20 years. There were the, you know, they were called anti-globalists. But yeah, there were people warning about, if things get shut down somewhere, you know, it's going to back up through the pipeline and people are going to die. That's essentially what happened, especially during the first half of the pandemic. I totally agree. And then you also have, you know, countries that can't be trusted in the same way. And then you had, you know, I tried to present the WHO fairly in the book. You know, they were demonized and blamed, but there were a lot of good people in the WHO who were honest in January about what was going on. They probably didn't push China as much as they could have, but the idea that somehow they were at fault for the fact that we are now at 228,000 deaths is just a fiction, right? I mean, they were carefully trying to make sure people didn't panic. But this idea that they had dropped the ball is, you know, it was a political invention. And
yeah.
they did the best they could over something that was, like, far bigger than they could contain, you know?
Well, for example, the WHO does not have any sort of authority to force other nations. You know, this is a voluntary thing. They have absolutely been sure for the past 5 or 6 years that there was a pandemic that was coming, that it was probably going to be some kind of coronavirus, because they were popping up more and more often as more and more of humanity lives closer to bats. It's going to happen. And they've been kind of saying all along, you know what, you better be ready, because it's not going to be pretty. And everybody said, no, we'll be fine.
Yeah, because we had been, we had been fine before. You know, my dad used to say, people die who have never died before. That was like his line he used to say. And it was an answer to, like, you make it through something 5 times, you think you're immune the 6th time. But I think we were, that's why the book is called Unprepared. It's not just a knock at the federal government. It's like the average American citizen was not prepared for this kind of invasion of, a medical nightmare. Right, we're not used to thinking in terms of community. We're not used to thinking in terms of wearing masks. All these things were foreign to us, so we were unprepared psychologically for the sacrifice, for the interconnectedness. It hit us over the head in a way that it's shocking that we're in late October now, Dave, and we're still dealing with the same issues that come up in March in this book. I mean, that's sort of the most upsetting thing is. Debates that were going on in mid-March are still being held in the press and, being sold by the president as if masks were up for debate, you know. Anthony Fauci made one comment in early March about, you know, hold off on buying up masks. We need masks for essential workers. That was the one sort of anti-mask statement he made, but it's been used for 8 months as like, well, you don't know. Fauci was for masks and then he was against masks. But, none of that is true, right? It's just it's a way to defend your position. So, again, the anti-science bias has gone up against Fauci. I'm glad he's staying in at least through the vaccine.
Yeah.
But just the kind of nonsense this guy has had to deal with. This is a man of science who's now dealing with death threats, who's dealing with worries about his job. Mm-hmm. And all he's trying to do is to get less people to die. But for some reason, that's a problem. You know, it's frustrating to watch.
Yeah. John, the book is absolutely fascinating. And I appreciate the fact that our listeners won't know this, but this is the second time that we've recorded a half an hour interview. The first time we had a technical problem that wasn't detected. And when we were all finished, I listened to the interview and you couldn't understand John at all. And I thought, well, I can try some electronic wizardry and fix this. Nothing worked. And he was gracious enough to come back on and give us a chance to talk again.
No problem. I enjoyed it.
It just was another irony to go along with it. John,
exactly.
Thank you.
Nothing goes as planned.
Yeah, absolutely. But we can hang in there and we'll figure it out. Hey.
Absolutely.
Our thanks once again to John Sternfeld, author and compiler of Unprepared, America and the Time of Coronavirus from Bloomsbury Publications. You can check his website, John Sternfeld, which is JonSternfeld.com. Find out more about Unprepared and about his other books as well. Look for your favorite bookstore and look for a copy of it. It's fascinating and just at times disturbing read. We'll see you next week right here on your favorite radio stations and your favorite podcast. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.